The Progressive Commentary Hour with Gary Knoll, Mondays at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, we have one guest and one theme, and we'll be inviting you to share your points of view a little later on in the program. My guest is Kevin Annett. He is a former minister with the United Church of Canada who was defrocked for his pursuing investigations and research into the Holocaust of Native American children, which has become better known as Canada's Genocide. His publications, which include Hidden from History, The Canadian Holocaust, and later Love and Death in the Valley, have created much of a storm in the Anglican Church. So much to talk about. We're going to get started immediately. Revealing Canada's own Holocaust against innocent children in the church-run Indian residential schools from which upwards of 50,000 Native American children never return. Nice to have you back with us, Kevin.
Hey, Gary.
Kevin, let's begin with the assumption that the people listening are not familiar with this. Take us step by step through what the story is and how for so long no one, not the BBC, none of the major news sources that could have uncovered this and certainly had the resources, chose to.
Well, it's interesting, just briefly on that first point, as far back as 1907, it was front page coverage on major newspapers in Canada that over half the children were dying in these Indian boarding schools. And so it's not that it hasn't been known in the public, it's just that it's part of an enormous system of repression and genocide. And so naturally there's been a kind of a gentleman's agreement that this stuff was not to be talked about. But I couldn't help but notice it. For me, it started in 1992 when I began to uncover these stories working with Aboriginal people on Vancouver Island. And I was fortunate to help them in their first lawsuits they brought in 1996 against the United Church and eventually the other churches. So I had from the beginning a fairly ground-level view of a lot of this stuff. And in a nutshell, what happened was there was a plan put together in 1910 in Canada to incarcerate all of the Indian children in these places they call schools. They weren't really, they were internment camps. And over from about 1910 onwards, it was law in Canada that every child had to be incarcerated in these places. By the time the last school closed in 1996, well over 50,000 children had died, and we have that from government statistics, from doctors' reports, from statistics that I published, and of course the eyewitness testimony. So this is a story which was, it's almost like the enormous elephant in the living room. It's so present that people don't even question it or look at it, although the evidence is certainly out there.
We're not in any rush. Take your time. Let's go back, and let's begin by looking at how these children got on these in these schools. And then take us day by day, what would have gone on in one of their lives. After all, this was going on right up till 1996, very similar to what was happening in Ireland with the young women, but these were women of Irish descent who their parents might have not wanted them, but they didn't want to get an abortion. And so they would take their babies or young girls or maybe a teenager acting out to a Catholic-run well, it was not a prison, but it acted like a prison. It was a laundry. All the people who administered were in the Catholic Church. All the funds were later shown to have gone back to the Vatican. And once in there, a young girl was there for the rest of her life. Some women lived 70, 80 years and never set foot outside of there. And if you did, the police would bring you back to the laundry. And it was only when a couple of the women managed to escape and get to London and told their story did this break open. At that time, the person overseeing all the laundries was the current Pope. In fact, he was also the Pope when he was Cardinal Ratzinger, who oversaw hiding thousands upon thousands of priests who had sexually molested tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of young people throughout the world, and he would hide them in places. And again, very powerful people within the Catholic Church who were, let's say, big supporters, kept this from getting out. This was going on for a long time, and once it finally did start to break through, it just spilled over. We now know about that, but we have not heard all about this and what went on here and the fact these were Native Americans. So take us in depth on this.
Well, it's true that it's part of a whole international system. It spans centuries and continents, and, you know, it's the same system in place, really. I think that just before I get into the details, a common denominator here in many cases is these places were very big money-making operations for the churches. Certainly in the case of the Indian boarding schools, they were often situated on very valuable resources, mineral and timber and other fishing grounds here on the West Coast. So the churches were given a certain amount of money per child, and they often didn't report children who had died to continue to get that money from the government. So I think the economic factor was a big one in all this. But in terms of the daily life that a child would face, they would often, and just before I mention this, people can listen to these stories themselves on our website, hiddenfromhistory.org. You can actually hear testimonies, you know, audio recordings of people, and also on our film Unrepentant, which also is on that site. But in terms of what would happen to a child, the RCMP, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, would show up in a village early in the morning while people were sleeping. They would round up the entire community and literally take every child in the village, often the cases of children being newborns taken out of the arms of their mothers, children as young as 2 and 3, and right up. All the different age groups were gathered up, chained or roped together, put on boats here on the coast or cattle trucks on the prairies, on trains and other means, and literally taken in chains to these camps that they called Indian boarding schools. Their heads were shaved. They were lined up. They were ordered not to speak their language or they'd be beaten or raped, regardless of the age. The other children who were encouraged to collaborate were given special treatment. So to give you an example, my friend Harriet Nahani describes when she was brought to the Alberni Residential School run by my former church, the United Church of Canada. The first day they were on the beach, there was 300 of them lined up crying and screaming and terrified because they were brought to this place. And she turned to her cousin to say something in her language. And a young Native boy dressed up in a uniform came over and smacked her on the side of the head and told her she wasn't allowed to speak her language. She could only speak English, even though she didn't know the language. That's the kind of regime you may immediately face. They were given no proper food. I've spoken to many people who had to literally break out at night and go through garbage cans to survive. Often that's how children witness killings or burials, because they were out at night foraging for food and they witnessed the burials happening. They were put in substandard conditions. They were deliberately housed with sick and dying children who were dying of tuberculosis. And in fact, Dr. Peter Bryce, who studied the health conditions in 1909, wrote a report saying that the conditions are being deliberately created to spread infectious disease. So these were like killing centers where children were being killed off to get the land to bring the native population under control. This is a regime that went on over decades, and there was all sorts of other things we've just begun to establish that went on. Regular use of children for drug testing, medical experimentation. There was a policy of sterilizing any native child who continued to speak their language, who wouldn't become a Christian and adapt. And it went on like that. The children were given rudimentary education, basic reading and writing skills, and then they were farmed out, the boys as field hands, the girls as domestic servants. There was a lot of child trafficking and pedophilia that went on. And so it was not unusual for children as young as 5 or 6 to be working as slave labor in the fields. And again, this went on right up to the modern era, right to the 1980s and 90s.
When did it begin, and who were the people responsible for creating this?
It formally began in Canada in the year 1891, where the government moved in and gave sanction and legal authorization to these mission schools that had been operating all over Canada before then. So the actual missionary schools dated as far back as the early 1800s. The government moved in and authorized them in the late 1800s. And so for, well over a century, these places were in operation. They were established according to a plan drawn up originally by the Jesuits, but the Protestant churches also adopted, the Catholic model. It came out of something in the West called the Duryea Plan. Bishop Duryea was a Jesuit who drew up a plan whereby native communities were targeted so that Catholic Indians who had been converted were brought in and replaced the traditional chiefs. The traditional elders were either killed off or imprisoned or terrorized off the land. And then Catholic Indians were brought in, and then they established a system of educating all the children in the Catholic religion. That was used as a model for the Indian industrial schools. Although they also drew on other countries, like in England, the industrial school system, where they incarcerated poor people in these workhouses, that also was kind of a factor. So it was a combination of church and state, working together right from the very beginning.
What would happen to the children as they got older? Becoming young adults.
Well, I mean, in terms of within the schools?
Yes. And then once they left, where would they go? What would they do?
Well, the ones who survived were completely destroyed by this. A lot of people would end up on the streets, either, alcoholic or just unable to function at all in society. Very few of them ever went on and got a job or higher education or anything like that. And some of them ended up, there was a high percentage of suicide of people who graduated, who went on after from the schools. I may meet many of these people in my work on the streets in Vancouver, and all of them, almost 9 out of 10 people, have the same story. Literally, they couldn't function, they couldn't hold a job, they'd been on welfare. It's one of the reasons in the Aboriginal community that you have such an enormous unemployment rate, and there's no way people can fit into a society that was trying to destroy them right from the beginning.
Now, when the mounted police would go to a home or a village and take every child, what was their legal mandate that allowed them to do this?
There was a law brought in Canada, federal law in 1920, which empowered the Royal Canadian Mounted Police and anyone deputized by the church. So, in other words, the church could designate anybody to go in with the power to arrest, and in the Indian Act it said to use any force necessary. So parents could be arrested or beaten or even killed, and there'd be no legal consequence on the ones who were arresting the children, bringing them in. So if the children ever tried running away, they were deemed as juvenile delinquents, and they were housed in prison alongside adults. So I mean, when you look at it all together, it's a way to simply criminalize the native population.
We know how the Americans, or at least in the United States, as our half of North America, because Canada and the United States are about the same size as far as landmass, and we know how the major seven tribes, there were more, but the largest seven tribes of the West were treated. There were 1,334 separate treaties. We broke every single one. And for the railroads to take their property and for mineral rights or anything else. And they had no rights, period. And was that the same in Canada or was it different?
Oh, absolutely it was. And in fact, in the West, it really began. The industrial Indian schools were set up within a few years of the Canadian Pacific Railway spanning the country. You had within that decade the creation of the RCMP, the Indian Act, the Indian Reservations, and the residential schools. And it was all a concerted plan of basically ethnic cleansing, getting the natives off the land prior to white settlement. There was a big concern among the British authorities that America was going to expand up and grab the West Coast. And so there was a real pressure on to settle the area very quickly with British English-speaking subjects. And so the Indians really had to get off the line quickly, and that's one of the reasons that the, you know, there were several big waves of smallpox that were deliberately introduced along the West Coast and in the interior. It simply paved the way for rapid European settlement.
Take a look at each one of the different churches, the Catholic Church, the Anglican Church, and the United Church of Canada, and their participation. At what point, when all this was exposed, did the leaders of those churches come forward and offer apologies, explanations, and any form of restitution?
Well, they never really have, not officially and not in a concerted way. The government intervened after an agreement with the churches and took the brunt of the financial burden and the responsibility for making the apology. So, in fact, the apology was issued in July 2008 by the Prime Minister. There was no mention of the churches. There was no mention of their liability. After the court cases began in 1996, the churches had to admit some responsibility. But in the year 2000, the government intervened and brought in legislation which actually restricted how much Native people could sue the churches for. They began to limit the liability of the churches. And in fact, from the very beginning, the churches have hid behind the government and the courts on this and have not at all been forthcoming. You know, a recent example of that is I'm working in Brantford, Ontario, with the Mohawk people unearthing a mass grave there. And we've already found bones which have been identified as being human, that of children. The Anglican Church, Church of England, has refused to release records of that school, even though they've acknowledged that some of those records involve details of the deaths of children in the school. And the government is allowing them to do that. And so the Mohawks are trying to get a court case going to have those documents released. But, you know, in effect, these churches have been completely absolved from any responsibility for these things, even though tens of thousands of children died under their care.
How many of these children could you guesstimate from the investigation you've done were murdered? And give us an example of how someone was able to murder a child, get away with it, with a full knowledge of the church, and since the churches would have been passing everything up the chain of command, it works very similar to the Catholic Church, certainly, and the Anglican Church, where the top person is the Archbishop of Canterbury, and the Catholic Church, of course, the Pope, how they pass this information up, so therefore everyone knew what was going on, and yet they condone murder.
Well, I can give you a very good example. The very first case I heard on the West Coast, that it was his first murder actually reported in the media in 1995, a woman, Harriet Mahaney, witnessed as a little girl. She was hiding under the stairs at the Alberni Residential School, and a United Church clergyman, Alfred Caldwell, who was the principal of the school, kicked a little girl called Maisie Shaw down the flight of stairs to her death. Maisie was 14. Alfred Caldwell had previously killed a little boy called Albert Gray at the Housed United Church School 3 years prior to that for taking a prune out of a jar when he wasn't supposed to. He was beaten so badly by Caldwell that his kidneys failed and he died. They didn't report it to the doctor. They let him bleed to death and die on a mattress. And two eyewitnesses who came forward describing taking the body out and burying it. Alfred Caldwell was never charged. He died as an honored United Church clergyman in the 1970s. It was never once mentioned, even though the stories had been out, because they were coming from Indians. The RCMP refused to investigate because under the Indian Act, Indians aren't citizens, and they don't have the same rights as other people in Canada. So, you know, these kinds of stories, there's many of those of eyewitnesses to killings. And, you know, if you go to my website, hiddenfromhistory.org, there's even a videotape there of a Native woman describing how when she was a little girl in 1944 in Saskatchewan, she saw a Catholic priest actually take a newborn Native baby and throw it live into a furnace because it was a result of the rape of a Native girl by a priest. And Irene Fable was the eyewitness, and she's describing that on a CBC broadcast. And there was never any follow-up to that story. There was never any shock on the face of the interviewer as she was describing it. It's as if, you know, it didn't really matter or it never had even happened, even though she saw it. So that's the kind of, I don't know what word you'd have for that, but it's like such a deeply entrenched denial about this stuff that it's very hard to break through that.
Kevin, you were the initiator of this dig at the one site of the residential school, and you're working with the local Indian across Canada and in three other spots to open children's graves. The Queen of England and the royal household and the government of Canada have been excluded from the crime sites by local Indian nations. Explain how all the churches and all the people have managed to get themselves excluded from being held responsible for what could be the preventable deaths of 50,000 children.
I guess the short answer, Gary, is that they're the law, so they can absolve themselves. Certainly the government's Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which you might hear about in the press now and then, the government set that up. The government and churches actually appointed the commissioners, so it's kind of like the suspected killer getting to nominate the judge and jury in the trial. They've arranged it so that they're not actually liable. And the Irish government did the same thing prior to the Ryan Report, where the Catholic Church actually was able to go through the Ryan Report and remove any names of priests, any suggestion that it was the Vatican involved in this cover-up. That kind of self-investigation, I guess you can come to expect what the result is going to be out of that. But in terms of why the Mohawks took the step they did, they realized for a long time, right from the very beginning, that they were not under the jurisdiction of the Crown of England, and they have never signed any treaty with the Crown. They've never relinquished their land voluntarily. And so they said, in this case, something as important as the recovering of our children and giving them a proper burial, they won't allow in the agents of the Crown, since those are the very people who would took the children away into the residential schools, the RCMP and the police, Crown agents, the Indian agent, and the Church of England. They were all the implicated parties here. So that was what was behind the reasoning. And in fact, what's interesting is ever since they announced that, the police have not entered the grounds of their territory. They've not gone in to try to enforce their own crime site. And the Mohawks are actually proceeding, as I speak, with that investigation. So, I think it's a recognition on the part of the government that they don't have any legitimate place there, and as long as Native people stand up, for their traditional rights, the government's in a quandary, because now they realize that the final evidence, the actual forensic proof of this is going to come out.
At this point, what are the rights of the Native Americans in Canada over their own territory, their lives, and the ability to create evidence and present it in a court of law? And if not in Canada, what about the other human rights courts and media in Brussels and London and Rome and elsewhere?
Well, it depends whose jurisdiction you recognize. Under Canadian law, and it says that right in the first paragraph of the Indian Act, it says all land is vested in the Crown. So the Crown of England claims the right through the Governor General in Canada and the Parliament here. It claims the right over all native land. So if you're living on reservation, and about a third of all natives in Canada still live on reserve, if you're living on reservation, you don't own your own land. You're given what's called a certificate of occupancy. And the land is actually administered for the Crown by the local native government-funded Indian chiefs. So they're agents of the Crown kind of administering the land that native people are, in other words, squatters on their own traditional territory. According to traditional native law, you have a dual system, and they say, no, we don't recognize that. We are still the legal owners of this land. And in those areas of the country where the native people have been organized enough and where they've retained enough of their memory to know that they have traditionally occupied those territories, in those areas there have been big fights over jurisdiction. There's been road blockades. There's been, in the Mohawk territory in southern Ontario, there have been land reclamations where men and women and children show up and block bulldozers and construction sites to stop any more destruction of their land. There's been a long battle among the very people who are authorizing the dig now at the Brantford School. Those same people have fought to retain their land for many years. So it's really kind of a civil war going on, and most Canadians aren't aware of that because they believe what's read in their newspapers, but they don't really understand this history. And that's the importance of what I'm doing, because it's bringing out that real history. It's telling people, well, this is how Native people got very messed up and dysfunctional in the first place, because of this whole legacy of torture and murder.
What has been the response by your original church and then by the media to you for exposing this and keep this in this context. It was, I'm sure you're familiar with Hermann Hesse, who said there's no reality except the one contained within us. That is why so many people live with such an unreal life. They take the images outside them for reality and never allow the world within to assert itself. So I'm sure at different times you have come to grips with this, where your reality, your truths, the evidence you have, the people you're speaking on behalf of, they're completely off the radar of the media, the government, the churches, and the average citizen's moral compass.
Right. That's exactly the situation. And, you know, it's very odd because when this whole thing started for me in 1995, I was hit with a ton of bricks by the church. Basically, they said, when I wrote a letter about the theft of land by the church and selling off of native land to local logging companies and that, I was told that I had to agree to a psychiatric exam, I had to agree to a year's training without pay. In effect, I was being scapegoated for having written that letter, and I was told that there was something wrong with me for having done so. And when I didn't go along with that and I questioned their motives, I was simply railroaded right out of the church. And as I mentioned in the last interview, in fact, they even went to my wife at the time and encouraged her to leave me and helped her with her divorce, and that's how I lost custody of my two daughters. And so, you know, at the initial stage in this is the church just did everything possible to discredit me and also ruin my life. And then, hoping that I'd crawl away and die somewhere. But the fact that I didn't do that meant that their whole strategy of trying to contain this issue changed. And what they then did is they began to simply start an enormous public misinformation campaign about everything I was doing, telling church people that I was crazy, that I had been a terrible clergyman, and that I was trying to bring down the church because of my animosity, you know, having lost my job and all that. Just, you know, the disgruntled ex-employee line. And then, you know, over the years, when they saw more and more people coming out and confirming what I was showing by this, they simply tried to ignore me. And what really it comes down to, and I recognize this having met other whistleblowers over the years, that there's a simple strategy, and that is to try. It's a psychological weapon aimed at anybody who's sitting on an uncomfortable truth, and that is you try to make the person doubt themselves and lose faith in their own truth. You make them feel, and I often say, I said this to my wife the other night, what they really tried to do is get me to doubt my own goodness, the fact that I had made a principled stand on behalf of these people. And they said in no uncertain terms it was wrong for me to have done that, and I was crazy to have done that. And they try to get the whole world to believe that. And unfortunately, you know, when you're up against a big institution, most people tend to go with the institution. They can't believe that one person could be right against an institution. So that's been the problem all along. And on the other hand, it's really, having persisted over the years, it's meant that a lot of people have had to sit up and take notice more than, you know, the fact that I did. So I think that's all
true.
Are
you familiar with Aldous Huxley?
Yeah.
He said, facts do not cease to exist because they are ignored.
Right.
So in the end, there will be people who will look for the truth, and there you will be. And there will be the legacy of all these tens of thousands of murdered and imprisoned children. And there will be the three major churches, the Church of England, the Anglican Church, the Catholic Church, and then the government. But they'll never be held accountable. Look, if you think what you're going through is bad, just imagine being one of the whistleblowers who saw that the Federal Reserve and the Bilderberg Group and the Council on Foreign Relations and this insidious need for power on these people's parts to take over our foreign policies and create wars. And yet when they would blow the whistle, nobody would listen because they were enamored by the personalities, the cult personalities of Bill Clinton and Ronald Reagan. They can't see these people for what they are and what they've done. One journalist committed suicide, Gary Webb, because all of American media turned against him when he talked the truth. So imagine all the other people in different levels who have seen the truth, and the world is not ready for their truth. We're not ready for the truth about anything in the United States. We're not doing a single thing, not a single thing, against global warming, the corruption of our democratic election process, Citizens United, allowing that corporations can be people with the same rights, they can buy elections, and the corruption of every part of our body politic. So it's not difficult for the person who is aware to realize what you've gone through is something that people are going through every day. The difference is you've had to do this pretty much alone, and you've been up against major institutions. So all the more power to you for still being here and continuing on, because now you have your documentary, you have your two books, and you have an audience who's now willing to listen to this story and say, at what point do we demand this Pope be held accountable for crimes against humanity? He was responsible for overseeing this, because he was the cardinal, chief cardinal in the Vatican under the Pope when this was uncovered, and had been so before then. So this was not a mystery to him. He had also been the chief cardinal in Ireland under the Laundries. He was the chief cardinal for 25 years protecting the Pope and the hierarchy of the Church when the pedophilia episode began and started hiding thousands of the clerics. They'd get them out of the country, wouldn't tell anyone where they went. And because the Vatican is a sovereign nation, they didn't have to, and they would not allow extradition. And what happened to that guy who molested two guys, but then it turned out to be 200 guys over a 25-year period? We don't know. Well, where's he at? We don't know.
But, you know,
and yet they did know. That's his pope. But because people think that when you're challenging a given person, you're challenging the entire belief system, they will rally around the religion and protect the misdeeds of those who had that religion. That's the sad part of this story as well.
Right. Well, it's a real kind of waking up process, and maybe the real story here is that this is all a means for us, you know, not to hold accountable, because the notion of accountability is based on the idea that these are responsible democratic institutions, and they're not. I recognize now that there's nothing illegal about genocide. In fact, it's a tool of state and religion. It always has been. There's nothing illegal about the violation and murder of children if it's in the interest of the government and the churches. And, you know, so we have to realize what we're part of, that the people who run society are criminals, that they you know, and we only have to look at our own history to see that. So what I kind of took from all that is that, well, then the way I've survived in this and made it force the issue is by continuing up the ante all the time and saying, okay, this isn't just about the persecution of one guy. It's about a whole hidden history, and we can't try to do it within the confines of Canada. As you mentioned earlier, this is a matter for international human rights courts. And even if that, too, is not going to be effective in the long run, what it will do is start to awaken everybody around the world to what we're part of. And this is just one tip of the iceberg, as you mentioned. This is opening our eyes to something we're part of that we can't be anymore. You know, we have to walk away from a lot of this stuff. And, that's why, you know, just on a personal level, the way I survive on this is to have my eye on the vision of, well, what does the world look like if we weren't part of that bloody tradition, if we got rid of these institutions and removed their power under the law to kill and get away with it. And that's something people have to do, or their own children are at risk. And that's something, you know, that we're learning painfully by this whole thing.
I'd like to open our conversation up to people in the audience. Normally, we don't take any calls, but I feel this is so important on so many levels that I would like people in North America listening right now, and this is the most downloaded radio program in America, North America. Last week we had 251,000 downloads, so you got a lot of people listening, and we'll over the next week. I'd like for them to have a chance to share their insights, questions, and points of view. I'm Gary Nall. You're listening to the Progressive Commentary Hour. My guest is Kevin Annett, A-N-N-E-T-T. He has spent time as a former minister of the United Church of Canada. He was defrocked, persecuted. He was harassed. Everything you could do against him, they did. Why? Because he had the temerity to investigate and research what would become the Holocaust of Native American children. And this was Canada's genocide. 50,000 innocent children in church-run Indian residential schools, prostituted, sexually molested, beaten, murdered, shopped out for child labor, not so different than some of our prisons in the United States. And he stood the course, and because of that he wrote Hidden from History, The Canadian Holocaust, and later Love and Death in the Valley. And he also has completed a film, a documentary, Unrepentant. And in fact, that won him the Best Director at the 2006 New York International Independent Film Festival. I believe I won it the year before for Drugging of Our Children. I wasn't there that year that you were there. I always like to come over and say hello to other documentarians.
Mm-hmm.
So let us open our call lines at 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. Now, once again, let's take a look at any different perspective before we broaden this out. I actually want to broaden this out to a mirror being reflected upon people. A lot of people are uncomfortable with Occupy Wall Street around the world. And it's not because of the political issues people are taking on. It's more often than not, it's because people are actually doing something. A generation that had been asleep is now awakening, at least a small part of them. And they're taking on people, and then once you look at what they're actually saying, and you pull back, they're saying, we have one group of people, and it's not 1%, it's more like 40% of the people actively participate in the greed. You know, no one had any banker or mortgage loan officer put a gun to your head and say, I've just written that your income per year is $200,000. The house you're buying is $600,000. We have to show that you make this amount of money in order for you to get this house. And the person says, well, I only make $25,000. No, you can walk away from that. But if people don't walk away and they agree to participate in lies, then what else are they going to participate in? Well, at some point, you're going to start looking at, if I'm against these people, who the people on Wall Street are against, does that mean that I have to, A, stop buying their products? Yeah. Stop putting money in their banks? Yeah. Ask my union or pension fund to take the money away from these people because they're investing it in gambling on commodities or buying up land in Africa for speculation? Yeah. And I must myself not make money off money. So in other words, if I really follow this to the end, I have to be a more moral, ethical person. That's it. Well, I don't want to be that. I'm not that, but I can pretend I am. I can write a story in my mind and sell it to people that I'm a good person. But do you do good things each day to justify the belief that you're a good person? Does your story align with your reality? No. Well, then you are what you do, not the story that you tell, that you've mastered. So I see this from a psychosocial dynamic that's a little more involved. That's one of the reasons we don't like protesters. We don't feel comfortable with them. Because why are they protesting? I'm not protesting. Why are they? Well, maybe they have found a truth that you're not willing to acknowledge. Well, what am I supposed to do with my life if they're reflecting in some way that makes me feel bad about myself? Well, then you do what Fox News does. You know, you disempower them, or what the major media does. You avoid it. So, Kevin, the issue you're raising is, why haven't a single major media anywhere in America, North America, found any inconsistencies in the assassination of JFK or Robert F. Kennedy or Martin Luther King? But they haven't. And those who have, the scholars, the people who have actually done the homework, have never, been given the forum to share that information because it doesn't align with the official story. Well, the official story of Canada is it's engaged in genocide to exploit the Native American. We did it here. Every country's done it. India's done it to its own. You know, imagine, you know, what we're looking at. We're looking at a pretty good size problem. And once you start to unravel it, you can't control it. You cannot control what will happen when people finally find their consciousness. So rather than find a consciousness, distract yourself. Let's watch television. Let's go buy something. Let's consume. Let's put our energy into distraction and sublimation. Yeah, that's a good idea. How about violent sublimation? Hockey. It's not a sport. It's a blood activity. Or let's go get a video game. The most popular video game ever is this new very violent one. And we're not even looking at ourselves for who we become. So that's what I see coming from what you and others have done. If we are willing to pull back and see what it says about a society in Canada. Because if you told your story and the Canadian people saw this for what you've seen it for and the victims saw it for, there'd be digging up grave sites, there'd be criminal investigations where there's no statute of limitation. Your thoughts, please.
That's right. Well, you know, it's no one ever likes to have a mirror held up to them when they're in, when they know they've been being engaged, even by association, with a crime, and this is very much the case. You know, even after 15 years of doing this, I've seen some slight changes in the way people approach it, but by and large, it's still the same kind of denial. And I don't want to be too trite in making an analogy with what you deal with in a family when people are facing death, but there is some parallels. The denial and the anger in the early phases of facing death, it's very similar to what my culture is facing. And in a way, it is a death. You know, people really accepted what we did to get this land and what we continue to do to hold on to it, and the desecration of Mother Earth and the destruction of the innocent all the time, all around us. If we really faced that and accepted it, I don't think people would be able to function or live with themselves. So a lot of this, I can understand the psychological protection people need to do, but where I begin to see that breaking down is when we're talking at the level of children, because that kind of lost innocence is a story we all carry. You know, we all have, to some degree, had that innocence intact in our life. And it's something we can relate to. And I find, in fact, there being a beginning to be a very human response to this. You know, we'll be holding protests or vigils outside churches, and people coming by in the street who learn about it are all very sympathetic, even cops and other people coming by. They're with us, but then they face the reality of, oh, you mean the church did this? Oh, you mean church officials ordered this? Well, I don't know if I can accept that, because it's going against their conditioning, how they've been taught to view religion and you know, like you say, the president or the prime minister or whoever, the queen. It's hard for them to imagine that these people are criminals and being involved in criminal activity. And so, but I do see that breaking down here and there. For me, it's a matter of persisting long enough for people to see that, yeah, we have to change our view of ourselves, and maybe this is one of the ways we do it.
So I would look at this in a slightly different way, and if you would, Kevin, please follow my thought here and then respond to it, if you would. I'm going to make a generality and allow for some exception, but not much. I believe that it's the people cannot believe that their elected leaders or those in the most powerful position to do something, because we defer the criticism of people, assuming that if they've gotten to this position, they must be very unique. I see it just the opposite. I see virtually all institutions run, education, all unions, the politicians, as psychopaths. Not necessarily sociopaths, but psychopaths. And then these individuals will do anything, say anything, to gain your trust. But they have to be very good at what they do, and they enlist an army. More often than not, these are dynamic, aggressive life energies. These are people that are very good at seeing the big picture, are very charismatic, and then they enlist the adaptive aggressives. These are the little... These are the individuals who will say and do anything, are very quick, very hip, very ruthless, very pushy. There are no boundaries in the life of an adaptive aggressive. There are no emotional boundaries, spiritual boundaries. There's no ethical boundary. They'll do anything that they want and need to get what they want because they believe in that old adage that the means justifies the ends. Now, they do this for the dynamic aggressive because they know on their own the dynamic aggressive cannot do this. And the dynamic aggressives get lost in the minutiae of details. They'll lecture to a group of 500 people, but they couldn't take the time to sit on the phones and organize the 500 people to come and hear them. They show up, they lead that energy, and then they go. And then all behind them is a whole group of people that field the functionality to keep these people in perpetual power. Rarely will the people within a union overthrow the heads of the union, even if the heads of the unions have been found to be corrupt. Now, you look at Bill Clinton, a serial womanizer, and the people do not know the full extent of it. A person who lied about everything, a person who says, I'm for union people, and the union people being adaptive, supportive, and that's the key. About 85% of all people in the world are adaptive. They adapt to the environment they're in, and they're supportive. They're like worker bees, and they support this. So they say, okay, and then they're told, we're doing it for you. Then NAFTA does just the opposite. It takes their jobs away, and yet the person continues to believe because the union leaders who get the benefits of making these deals, they're never out of work. They're never the ones who have to sacrifice or worry about a missed mortgage payments. They're the ones who always get a president calling saying, hey, Bob, how's it going over there at the F? And, oh, we're going great. Well, you know, we're going to be having a special get-together here in Washington. We'd like you to come bring your wife. Sure. Now you have the leadership. And by the way, I saw this for decades being an integral part of the environmental movement. And I saw when Al Gore started passing footballs and having lunch on Friday afternoon with the heads of the environmental movement was co-opted. And that's exactly what happened. And I read them the Riot Act this year, where I was a keynote speaker on Earth Day at the UN. The whole room was filled, top to bottom, with environmental group activists. And I said, shame on you for selling your soul to get close to power. But they weren't alone. All the time people sell themselves to get close to power because they feel that's the place to be, because we do not challenge people when they're in a position of power if we're aligned with them. If we want our person in power, well, then we'll criticize the person in power. But again, we don't criticize our person. So if our person lies, and we know they lie, if they cheat, if they betray their wife, that's okay because they're still much better than we are. Well, no, they're not. These are all psychopaths who lie, will do anything to get and keep power, and you then don't want to see them for who they are. You want to believe the story that their publicists and groups put out. Mm-hmm. That happens all the time, every day. Shame on the Democrats, shame on the Republicans, because they are the worst manifestation of psychopathic behavior. And the professors running the think tanks on the left and the right, the people in the media on the left and the right, they are the supporters and enablers of this. Just tonight, Al Sharpton, and then it'll be, Keith Olbermann and Rachel Maddow and Lawrence O'Donnell, and they will be there to support Obama because they are the problem. They're not stupid. They're not without analytical means, but they are consumed by this need to maintain their own power by supporting the existing power within the official lines of that, in which case then if there's going to be an investigation, it will not be about them, on them, what they believe in, what they have built. It'll be on someone else. And hence then, who's going to be honest about anything if everybody's got a dog in the fight to keep honesty on the outside of this fight? Your thoughts on this, Kevin?
Well, you know, for me, the question is always not that there's psychopaths in power, because I think it's been that way for thousands of years, but why does a majority go along with it? I had an example of this. In 1983, I was at the university, and there was a general strike in British Columbia about 250,000 people, shut down the whole province. And the top union guy who was running the strike made a secret deal with the premier of the province behind the door deal that sold everybody out. Everybody went back to work on the order of one guy. And to me, that's plagued me over the decades, because I thought, well, how is it that people who would become so conscious, so aware, so determined to be out there and fight for something and to fight for one another go back to work when one man orders them to? And I think that if you take anyone and look at them, they recognize within themselves that, I mean, if you want to quote Jesus, the truth or the kingdom of heaven is within each one of us, and we know that. We are our own authority. We don't have to acquiesce to anything or anyone, but there's something that happens to us in childhood where we're raised in society, and I think it's what I'm getting my hand on with this work and why so many people don't want to look at it, is it's getting at the heart of how people are conditioned en masse to acquiesce to authority, and that is to devalue themselves, to doubt themselves, to say there's always an expert who knows better. There's always somebody else I have to acquiesce to and hand over my authority to, you know, the panacea of voting. To hand over your authority to somebody else instead of being self-governing. And I, you know, it's, all of that is at work, in this, and it's, you know, I agree with most of what you're saying. It's just that on a practical level, when you confront people with the truth, the first question I always hear from people in the work I do is, well, what can I do about it? Well, this is the church and the government. Okay, what can I do about it? And I say, you can do everything about it.
You can stop flying on airplanes, and why aren't we sitting in and boycotting the sexual molestation of everyone who gets groped by going through a TSA? Or how about sitting in around the police headquarters where people who were supposed to be there to serve the public's interest seeing passive, nonviolent demonstrators, but they're come armed for conflict and engaging conflict and provocation? And yet we do not question why are people engaged in this. We you know, well, I'm a part of the system. So when you become a part of the system, then you acquiesce. You give away that power. Rare is the police officer who will go in front of the other police and say, this is a peaceful demonstration. You do not need your guns, your batons, your pepper spray. And we haven't seen that. What we see is the people in the armed forces, the people who have been militarized in the police, the bureaucrats who believe nobody can touch them now, the police officer who can pull over a billionaire and say, now you're in my game. I have the power. You don't. We are either so devoid of power, or we have aligned with such malignant power that we have forgot what is spiritual power, and we do not have any leaders currently in the world who are coming from a spiritual perspective, nor have we in a long time. Remember, Gandhi was not a political leader. He was a social leader. And Martin Luther King was a social leader, not a political leader. Let's say hello to Carrie from Washington, D.C. Hi, Carrie. You're on.
Yes, Gary. I really appreciate this program. And what I would like to add to the conversation, I'm listening when you're talking about the different types of personality types and these different character types, rather, and you have the, you know, these people who are adaptive and these other different type of super type A people. And in my view, and this is just my view, one person here, when when I look at things as a black person on the planet, I see myself as a being on this blue marble of a planet of water and dirt and volcanoes, what have you, in the middle of outer space, in the far corner of wherever, and I'm in a space where there are some people who have decided that they are the all power. So it's not just that individuals have the notion of type A, but it's their races that have a whole collective type A personality that is extremely aggressive. And so I think that because when a group decides that they are all power equals God, then I think that what we have to do is look at what are the dynamics, and for me as a black person, the dynamics is white supremacy. And the white supremacy mentality is what's governing, even though you have different groups of people in other cultures who may have done things, sometimes those things are taking their cue from the white supremacy model.
You've made a couple interesting comments.
And the last thing, what I was going to say, which is dominating you know, which is really dominating all of the colored people over the planet in whatever area or levels they may be within the construct.
Okay, you've made some interesting points. Would you consider the following, however, not to use the word white supremacy, but rather use the word power supremacy? Because I can show you African Americans who are engaged in genocide. I can show you prison systems and military-industrial complexes. I can show you acts of war committed by very powerful African Americans. I can show you people in each society who will dominate. If you go to Africa, look at who some of the worst, who are the greatest criminals against their own people. It is the power that corrupts, and it is really not the issue that it's only whites that are capable of creating a power to themselves, in which case they become supreme. It was Thomas Carroll who said, all reform except a moral one will prove unavailing. Nor was the great George Bernard Shaw who said, reformers have the idea that change can be achieved by brute sanity. So what we're looking at is not to blame a race, because in every race, there's still the same hierarchical order. Even if you took a group of slaves, you will find the one slave that is dynamic, the one that is creative, assertive, the one that is adaptive, is supportive. You will have it in any given group. It doesn't mean as a group that they have the power, but those who become a part of the official institution have to take on the same use of power. Was it not Colin Powell who, when he was the top military commander under Schwarzkopf, denied the value denied the reality of Gulf War syndrome and its causes, biological and chemicals used in the first Gulf conflict, which we've proven in my documentary, Killing Our Own Gulf War Syndrome, proved that. And was he not was he not the one that sold us into a mass genocide with over 1,500,000 dead, 2 million currently displaced in their own land in Iraq, and over $5 trillion, 44,000 permanently injured, 5,500 dead Americans, and he had the choice to say no. It wasn't his color that told him to say yes or no. It was his alignment with power. So if you can associate power as the problem and not a race, not an ethnicity, and not a gender or sexual association with it, then I believe that we are talking in alignment. And I thank you very much for calling in and sharing your points of view. Let's say hello.
I would like to agree with...
Yeah, go ahead.
I think it's important. One of the things, I'm sorry, I forgot her name. But the sister who called, as a European derived person, you can call me white if you like, but I have to take responsibility for the crimes done in my name. And there is a, I deal with this a lot in the Native world, in that if I was Native, I'd be dead by now. And that my white skin, to some degree, has protected me. So it's not a kind of an even playing field where we're all guilty of crimes and we're all guilty. I mean, there is historically a specific responsibility I need to take.
Kevin, we're up to about a minute to go. But would you not take one last second, Kevin? I understand what you're going. But before I hear another white guy tell me how we as whites or as Caucasians have it good, let me show you the 100 million dead white men in battlefields throughout the world who had no power not to go and had no power to serve.
I'm not right? saying we had it good. In fact, the first slaves in America were white indentured servants from England. I know that. I just meant it's a reality I deal with. And before we go off the air, I wanted to just do a final mention. My latest book, Unrepent and Disrobe of the Emperor, is up on Amazon. And if you go to hiddennolonger.com, you can read a lot of this evidence. And itccs.org is the a lot of our work we're doing now on the tribunal is posted there. So I just wanted to mention that to listeners.
Kevin, you've done a remarkable job. I have tremendous respect for this work. And my hope is that someone in the Canadian media, as well as someone in the world courts, will take this issue on and take it to another level. Having someone within the official positions also means that they must then have an official response to it. as long as you are marginalized and kept to the periphery, then nothing within the mainstream, nothing within the official church, the official government, the official media, and the official public consciousness that keeps itself sane and safe by never having to commit itself to looking at your truths will go by. And let us hope that someone brings your story into them where it becomes something that embarrasses them, shames them into looking at their own legacy.
Well, I know this has helped, Gary. I appreciate being on the air. And if people want to get a hold of me to help with that, I'm at hiddenfromhistory1@gmail.com. So please write.
Kevin, all the best to you. And if any more breaking news comes, please feel free to call. You always have a forum here to use.
Thanks so much, Gary.
Kevin Annette, I'm Gary Knoll. You've been listening to the Progressive Commentary Hour. I want to thank you all for listening in. I want to thank those people who have taken the time and will share this information with others. We ask you to download the programs and share them. And Carrie from Washington, D.C., thank you very much. Carrie, I appreciate you calling in and stimulating some thought on these issues. I'm Gary Knoll. Have a good day.